easily half again as tall as the bridge. Kip braced himself and took a deep breath. He didn't notice he'd clamped his eyes shut until he heard Iron Fist's quiet chuckle. He opened his eyes as the last of the water sluiced off the outside of the tube harmlessly. The bridge hadn't groaned, hadn't shuddered, hadn't even acknowledged the power of the wave that had just fully passed over it. A few passers-by grinned knowingly. Apparently this was the kind of joke that didn't get old.
"Is this why—"
Kip stumbled as he reminded himself to use the correct term.
"Is this why my uncle wanted me to come this way?"
"Part of the reason, I'm sure. Any time we have to deal with a recalcitrant king, or satrap, or queen, or satrapper, or pirate lord, we make sure they come across at high tide. It's a good little reminder of whom they're dealing with."
Little reminder? The next wave crashed over the bridge as well, and soon even the wave troughs were higher than the bottom of the bridge. By the time Kip and Iron Fist stepped off the bridge, it was half submerged in the sea. Unbelievable. Kip hadn't grown up on the sea, but even he knew that the tide coming in so hard and high and fast was unusual. It made him wonder if there was some magic to that, too. And through it all, the bridge didn't even shudder. Some reminder. The bridge curved up before it spilled them onto the shore, of course, but when it did, Kip was finally able to start paying attention to the Chromeria. The first two towers, to the right and left as one stepped onto Little Jasper, were set narrower than the back two towers, either to help strengthen the wall near the huge gate where it was most likely to be attacked, or... oh, it's all about the light. As soon as Kip realized that, everything else made sense. Everything about the Chromeria was designed to maximize exposure to sunlight. Building on a slope meant that more sun could reach the lower levels of the northerly towers and the yard. Having the first two towers of the hexagon set narrower meant that they didn't cast shadows on the back towers. The glass, northern walls, and the north sides of each of the towers meant that every north-facing room got as much sunlight as they could use, while the southern rooms had opaque walls more amenable to privacy and comfort. Kip imagined that those with a stifling fear of heights might not do well in some of the Chromeria's rooms. Minimizing its footprint and adding to the flaring lily shape, all the towers except the central one leaned out. It was no accident, either. Despite the lean, the floors were all level. Perhaps it was that the Chromeria needed more space than was available on the island, so the only way to have more space was to make the towers extend beyond the island. Perhaps it was simply because they could. Either for support or convenience, there was a lattice of translucent walkways between each tower and its adjacent ones. Encircling the central tower halfway up, a clear walkway connected to the tower at two points, and then radiated out to each of the other towers in turn. Kip could see that those enclosed walkways were filled with people making their way between towers. Doubtless it was much faster if you had business high in each tower to be able to travel directly, rather than walk all the way down the stairs, cross the central yard, and then climb all the way back up. But the visual effect remained. The air around the central tower, like a flower's style, was kept uncluttered, prominent.
"Each color has its own tower," Iron Fist said.
"Thought you weren't a guide,"
Kip said before he could stop himself.
He blinked.
If he didn't dislike pain so much, he would have physically bit his tongue to give himself a reminder. Iron Fist simply looked at him.
"Sorry,"
Kip squeaked. He cleared his throat and said, deeper,
"I mean, sorry."
Iron Fist still looked at him flatly.
"Let me guess,"
Kip said, squirming, wanting to deflect Iron Fist's intense gaze. He pointed at the tower to the left of the gate they were approaching, then in a sunwise circle.
"Sub-red, red, orange, yellow, green, and blue."
Blue was the last one, just to the right of the gate.
"Good guess," Iron Fist said reluctantly.
"So why do the superviolets get bent over the fence?"
Kip asked.
"Excuse me?"
Iron Fist's voice pitched higher.
"You know,"
Kip said.
"What?"
Iron Fist's right eyebrow climbed.
"Like for a whipping."
"That expression doesn't mean what you think it means,"
Iron Fist said. Kip opened his mouth to ask what it did mean then, but could tell the commander wasn't going to tell him.
There are never enough superviolets to fill an entire tower, and superviolets can draft best if they are higher up. The quality of light there is better for their work, plus a good majority of their work is directly for the white. So they inhabit the Prism's tower, close to the top.
They walked to the great gates with hundreds of other people who were coming to work or conduct business. The gates were covered with beaten gold, but were open, so Kip only caught a glimpse of the scene and figures depicted on them. The walls, however, were a wonder themselves. It became obvious that blue Luxon was their main element, but the Luxon itself could be lighter or darker, and it apparently had to be mixed with yellow. For strength? That had to be it, given that the entire bridge was made of that mix. But each wall of the hexagon was different. There were patterns of blue and yellow and green throughout, and that wasn't even including the towers. While the north side of each tower was as close to perfectly transparent as possible for maximum sun exposure, the rest was constructed to mark the buildings for their owners, so that even the untrained could tell which building belonged to whom, and, apparently, to show off. Every surface of the blue tower was cut like a giant sapphire, so that the entire tower gleamed off a thousand surfaces no matter what angle you saw it from. The sub-red tower, over its base of interwoven blue and yellow and green, seemed to burn. Illusory flames licked up the Luxon for 10 and 20 feet, and occasionally threw sparks and flames even higher. All the rest of the tower seemed to ripple, like the air over a fire. Kip stumbled as they entered the central yard. He looked at his feet. Great grooves cut the ground in a broad arc connecting the gates. But the gates Kip had passed didn't slide shut. They just shut on hinges, like normal doors. He looked at Iron Fist, confused.
"Glass flower," Iron Fist said.
"Huh?
What do flowers do?"
"Look pretty." Iron Fist looked pleased to have stumped him.
"With regards to the sun."
"They open?"
"And how would that work with a group of buildings?"
Kip thought about it, and gave up.
"It wouldn't,"
Iron Fist said. "Oh, then..."
"Try again."
"Do you ever answer questions straight?" Kip asked.
"Only to my superiors,"
which was, Kip realized, a straight answer. He wrinkled his nose, too intimidated by Iron Fist to point that out, but the twitch at the corner of the big man's mouth told him he knew.
"Flowers follow the sun from morning to night,"
Iron Fist said, perhaps by way of apology. Kip looked at the tracks again as he and Iron Fist approached the central building. Before the road came to the gate, it flared wide, so wide that most of it simply abutted the wall in a wide crescent.
"You mean the whole thing turns?"
It was the only thing that made sense, Kip realized. If the buildings were all transparent on the north side, they would only take full advantage of the sunlight in the middle of the day. But if the whole compound turned, they would get maximum light from dawn until dusk.
But all of it? Impossible.
"Here we are,"
Iron Fist said. Kip swiveled his head back to the front as they stopped in front of a huge silvery gate. It was as plain as everything else here was ornate. Two guards on either side of the gate, dressed in full mirror armor, each wearing a sword and holding a matchlock musket nearly as tall as he was.
"Commander Iron Fist," they said in greeting.
"Finally,"
Iron Fist said, pushing Kip inside.
"You are about to meet the Thresher."
Chapter 36. Meetings with Dazen were always a practice in deception. Gavin's tightened chest didn't ease at the sight of his brother. He should have killed him years ago. How simple that would have been. How simple it still could be. All he needed to do was stop dropping bread down the chute. Just like that, his problem would go away. He thought of it every morning, after every sleepless night. But this was his brother. He hadn't killed him in the heat of battle, how could he kill him in cold blood? 7 years. 7 purposes. 3 times now, he'd put "tell Caris everything" on the list. Not just about loving her, about this. That Dazen wasn't dead, that he was here. That so much was built on lies. She deserved to know. She could never know. because if she knew, it might bring them reconciliation and happiness together, or it might bring a new war to consume the seven satrapies. "Hello, brother," Gavin said again. The air was cool on his skin, the scent of resin and stone inescapable. He braced himself for the response. His brother, after all, was a guile, too. And unlike Gavin, he had nothing else to think of except what he would say to Gavin the next time he came to visit. That, of course, and plot to escape. After 16 years, most men would have given up, but not a guile. That was their legacy. Absolute, unreasoning faith in their supremacy over other men. "Thank you, father."
"What do you want?"
Dazen asked, his voice rough from disuse. "Did you know that during the war I fathered a bastard? I just found out about a month ago. As big of a surprise to me as to anyone. But all sorts of things happen during war, don't they? Caris was furious, of course. She wouldn't share my bed for 3 weeks, but, well, making up with Caris has always been so good that I almost want to fight with her." He looked up and left and smiled for an instant as if at a private memory. It was important to layer the lies with a guile. In Gavin's narrative to his brother over the years, he had established an alternate life. He and Caris were married, but had no children, a nagging heartache, and a source of conflict with Andros Guile, who wanted Gavin to put Caris aside and find a woman who could produce heirs. He leaked those details slowly, grudgingly, making his brother work to uncover them. Then, every time, Gavin could leak more information to see if his brother looked either confused by the lies or contemptuous of them. Dazen had a nasty smile on his face.
"So, who was it? Do you even know her name? Did she have proof?"
He was fishing, hoping Gavin would give him something for nothing, and he would suspect Gavin if Gavin gave it to him. But Gavin went ahead. "His face is proof enough. He's the very image of Sebastian." Dazen's face paled.
"Don't you bring Sebastian into your lies, you monster. Don't you dare."
"We've adopted the boy. His name is Kip. Good kid, smart, talented. A bit awkward, but he'll grow."
"I don't believe you."
Dazen looked sick. He might not believe it, but he was close.
"Who's the mother?"
Gavin shrugged as if it didn't matter. "Lena."
"You lie!"
Dazen snarled and slapped a hand against the blue Luxin separating them.
"Caris would never take that harlot's bastard."
It was real fury. After 16 years bathing in placid blue light, something deep and hot and too instant to be false. Which told Gavin 3 things. But some purposes are best achieved by misdirection. "She had a rosewood box," he said, "about this long. Do you know what was in it?" The expression on Dazen's face told Gavin he'd made a mistake. Head pulled back, stunned, then confusion, hope, and finally laughter. There was genuine joy. Dazen kept laughing, shaking his head, prolonging the laugh now, rubbing it in. He leaned against the blue Luxin between them, but naturally, confident.
"Here's what bothers me more than everything else," Dazen said. "More than your betrayal. More than your murders. More than the cruelty of imprisoning me rather than just killing me. More than you stealing Caris. More than all the rest of it together. How is it that no one has noticed?"
"We're not doing this again, dead man," Gavin said. "You don't want to trade? Fine, I'll be going."
"This is my trade. Let me hear you say it, and I'll tell you all about the dagger."
"Dagger?" Dazen had dropped that tidbit deliberately. Oh, shit. Gavin had overlooked something. His chest tightened, throat clamped shut. It was hard to breathe, harder still to keep his face smooth. There was no one here. No one who could overhear if he said it aloud. It wasn't new information. If he could get new information for old, it wasn't a loss. But it felt like one. Gavin moistened his lips. "My name is Dazen Guile, and I stole your life."
"How'd you do it, Dazen? How did no one notice?"
"I took your clothes and strode out of the flames at Sundered Rock. My face was swollen from our fight. I'd already given myself your scar and cut my hair like yours. I just started giving orders and your people became mine. I just acted like a selfish asshole and everyone assumed I was you," he said, feigning nonchalance. The prisoner laughed, ignoring the last part.
"Well, it's a beginning. Feels good, doesn't it?"
They say confession is good for the soul.
Dazen, Gavin, snarled. Now, about that dagger.
It's my vengeance, little brother, the prisoner said. It is the sweet song of victory, the prisoner said. It is the sting in the night, dryness in your bones, sleeplessness and terrors. It is your death and my freedom, Dazen. It is the end of all your lies.
And apparently I've only heard the beginning of yours, Gavin said, sneering. His brother was lying. Had to be. He was just trying to make Gavin worry. He was chained, not witless, confined, not toothless. The real Gavin laughed.
No, you see, the beauty of it is that I don't have to lie. What are you going to do, little brother? You don't have the spine to starve me. No, you'll just watch it coming. Death will draw his sword and you will stand and do nothing. It's always been your way.
He laughed again.
I have nothing more to say to you. Begone.
Dazen trembled. Every word his brother said touched some deeper well. The time Carys's elder brother Rodin had sworn to beat Dazen, and Dazen had stood still, waiting, not really believing Rodin would do it until it was too late. The terrible dreams Dazen had had as a child, and for which the elder Gavin had mocked him. Even being dismissed, as Dazen had always hated. Or Hollum, damn him. Gavin had always known the cracks in his armour. Dazen shook his head. No, he was Gavin now. The mask had to be total, even in his own thoughts, at all times. Dazen was another life. Dazen was the wretch on the other side of the Luxon now. Dazen was the weak bastard trying to anger him so that Gavin would kill him. That's all this was. The prisoner was terrified, weak. He was a shell. He was trying to provoke Gavin to kill him because he couldn't summon the courage to suicide. That was all. The man Gavin had once been would have killed the prisoner and been done with it. In the war, Dazen had become ruthless. Dazen loved the clash of arms, the splash of blood. Dazen loved his mastery over other men. Dazen would crush those who rose against him. Now, as Gavin, he wouldn't be pulled back to that. He wouldn't give his brother the satisfaction. Well, Gavin said, it was a pleasure, as always, but it's getting late. Of course, it was barely noon, but he liked making the real Gavin wonder just how disoriented he was down here. And Carys is eager tonight. She made me promise not to keep her waiting. That's for cheating on her and leaving me with a mess, you bastard. So a good evening to you, Dazen. The prisoner said, your lies are failing already, Dazen. You just keep wondering who already knows and how they're plotting against you. Sweet dreams. There are worse things than waking from a nightmare to find yourself in the arms of the woman you love. Say, waking in a cell. Sweet dreams to you too, brother. Gavin touched the glass, and it went dark, and once more the cell began its slow, slow rotation into the earth. Gavin leaned against the cold wall, trying to calm his racing heart. It wasn't a loss. He'd learned some things from his brother. First, he had indeed been cheating on Carys. Kip was Gavin's bastard. Second, Gavin had known Kip's mother, and she wasn't a prostitute. If she had been, he would have said, Carys would never take a harlot's bastard. Instead, he'd said, that harlot's bastard, which meant he intended the word as a slur, not a description. Third, unless he was far, far smarter than Gavin gave him credit for, which was possible, the real Gavin still wasn't getting information from the outside. That was why Gavin had put all of his lies all in the past tense, Kip's discovery. A month of not sharing a bed with Carys. Decisions already made about raising Kip. If someone were passing him news, the prisoner would be confused by the chronological disparity, which, because it didn't seem to serve a purpose, he wouldn't expect to be a lie. Gavin didn't expect his brother to voice his confusion, of course, but he was hoping to see it in his eyes. But there had been none. So Dazen wasn't getting information from the outside, which meant he wasn't plotting with this colour prince, whoever the hell that was. So the Colour Prince was merely using a retelling of the Prism's war to agitate dissent. All the world believed Gavin had won, and the Colour Prince didn't like how things had turned out, so he was pretending to be in league with the losing brother, whom he had no idea was actually alive. This colour prince was a liar, and an opportunist, then, not a zealot who knew the truth. Which meant there was only one place the colour prince could be. Tyria. Either King Haradul was the colour prince himself, or the two were connected. Thank you, brother. Very helpful. And you used to be better at lying than I was. But after the prison finally settled into place, he checked and double-checked all his chromaturgy. Nothing was out of place. And yet, even as he ascended up the shaft and out of the Evernight he'd created down here for his brother, he trembled. He was as trapped as Gavin was. I could just stop feeding him. I wouldn't even have to do anything. I could just take a vacation, tell Mauricia not to drop the dyed bread down the chute while I'm gone. He'd simply die. He remembered when they'd been children and Dazen had climbed the lemon tree to prove he could do everything his older brother could, and fallen. They thought he'd broken his ankle. Gavin had carried him all the way home. A small thing for an adult, but Gavin had been reduced to tears by the effort. But he refused to give up. His little brother had never forgotten it. And now the little brother is going to kill that man in cold blood, without even having the courage to face him as he did it? Enough. All the world knows your brother is dead. You are all they know. Besides, you need your wits about you. You have to tell the Spectrum you started a war, and then you need to convince them to fight it your way. I do have a chance, just as long as the White's in a good mood. Unless... Oh, Gavin Guile, sometimes you do play a deep game, don't you? He grinned to himself. 7 years, 7 goals. 1 impossible prize. A small failure could serve his greatest success. Gavin made it back to his room and was putting everything back in place to disguise the door in the closet again when there was a sharp rap at the door. He threw the closet closed as the White opened the door.
"Good to see you, Lord Prism," she said.
Gavin was painfully aware of the mess in front of him and the burn on the back of his shirt, a burn he had no good way to explain if she saw it. "And you, High Mistress?" he said, smiling. "Just the person I wanted to talk to. If we could meet in a few moments, perhaps in your chambers?" Aurea Palar looked at him sharply.
"I'm afraid that's going to have to wait. There's a class waiting for you. A class you promised me you'd teach."
Her nose twitched.
"Did you burn something in here?"
Yes, Gavin said. It came out as a question.
Damn it. Yes?
Gavin cleared his throat. Yes. She waited. He said nothing more.
Very well, then. Be like that. I thought you left to take care of that colour White.
Ah. She was angry because she thought he'd neglected a mission whose abandonment might mean people dying. And she would have been sure, it being a blue, that he would go immediately, and she didn't know why he'd summoned the Spectrum. The White didn't like to be left in the dark. "Consider it taken care of," Gavin said, which she would interpret to be him blowing her off, but he didn't know how to not tell her about the Skimmer if he was fully honest. After showing it to the boy and Karis, it was a secret he couldn't expect to keep much longer, but that would be a big conversation, and he wasn't ready for it yet. She lifted her eyebrows, like, "You're going to be dismissive? To me?" A thought hit him. "The class is superviolets?" The White nodded, suspicious. "There's a girl from Tyria in that class, isn't there? Olivia?"
"Olivia Nadanovus, from Recton."
So he'd remembered correctly. A girl from Kip's town. Perfect. He hesitated. Kip had said Corvin was there, but no relation, surely.
"Actually, she's General Danavis's daughter."
Gavin let the shock show as dull surprise, like he'd just heard about some minor tragedy on the other side of the world. He'd heard the girl's surname was Danavis before, but he'd assumed it was some distant relation, if any. Corvin's own daughter? And why had Corvin been living in the same town as Gavin's bastard? Coincidence? If so, that was a heavy coincidence. Regardless, it required Gavin's attention right away. "Huh, you're right, I need to go teach that class. It's a holy responsibility." Juggling. Always juggling.
"I always distrust you when you get dutiful," the White said.
He smiled. blandly innocent. Chapter 37. It seemed to Kip that the entire first floor of the prison's tower was a jungle of benches, desks, signs, queues, and clerks. Obviously, the whole business of the Chromeria passed through this room. There were queues for traders seeking contracts for food, queues for traders delivering contracted food, the same for every other trade good Kip could imagine. Queues for redress of grievances caused by Chromeria residents, queues for labourers seeking work, queues for adjudicating fee disputes on Big Jasper. There were even queues for nobles, although there were many more clerks staffing that one than any of the others. The room had a busy hum, but despite the crowd it was obvious that the Chromeria ran like a well-oiled mill. The people were impatient, but not angry, bored, but not surly. Commander Ironfist led Kip to a desk with a single clerk, and no queue at all.
All the rest of this year's darks were admitted weeks ago.
Darks? Kip asked.
That's what people like you are called, unofficially. Supplicants, officially. You want to be part of the Chromeria, but you aren't yet. So you're a dark. Darks. Dims. Glims. Gleams. Beams. But you don't need to remember any of that right now.
Kip opened his mouth. Shut it. Ironfist said nothing until they reached the desk. The clerk, obviously daydreaming, sat bolt upright when he noticed Commander Ironfist.
Oh, yes, Commander, how may I assist you?
I have a supplicant for immediate testing.
Immediate as in...
Now!
The clerk's throat bobbed.
Yes, Commander. Supplicant's name...
Kip. Kip Guile,
Ironfist said. The clerk grabbed his quill, began writing. Got halfway. Froze.
Guile as in...
As in no one needs to hear it from you. Is that a problem?
Ironfist asked.
No, sir. I'll just go talk to my superiors. You could go ahead up to the testing room. I'm sure the testers will be along presently.
With a quick bob of his head, the clerk got up and ran to a back office.
I understand the rest, but what's a glim?
Kip asked as they climbed the stairs together. He trod on his sagging pant leg, which had fallen lower as he climbed the stairs, and he almost pitched forward on his face. He cleared his throat and hiked up his pants. Life would be so much easier if he had a waist.
A glimmer,
Ironfist said. Ah, dark, dim, glimmer, gleam, beam. A light progression, then. Ironfist said,
Now, quiet. This is supposed to be solemn. You go into the room, and don't say anything until your testing is finished. Got it?
Kip almost said yes, then nodded instead. This might be harder than he had thought. Ironfist gestured to the door, and Kip walked in. Ironfist closed the door behind him. The room was utterly plain. One wall curved slightly inward, so Kip guessed that was the outer wall of the tower. Other than that irregularity, the room was a square, 10 paces wide, all white stone, with a single wood table and a single wood chair. The room was lit by a strange white crystal set into the wall, the same kind Kip had seen in all the halls, and even, now that he thought of it, in the great room downstairs with all the queues. Kip flopped into the chair. It had been an exhausting week. It had only been yesterday that he'd been skimming across the waves, that he'd tried to drown, tried to sail. Had it only been a few days since... No, Kip wasn't going to think about that. Too jagged, too heavy. He'd be blubbering again if he wasn't careful. He'd been waiting for several hours when he heard the muffled exchange of angry words from the hall. That was definitely Ironfist, laying into somebody. Kip swallowed hard. He wanted to get up and eavesdrop, but he knew that with his luck, as soon as he got to the door, it would open. Whatever the argument had been about, it was over as quickly as it began. The door didn't open. Kip waited. And waited. He was just starting to get tired, eyes drooping, when the door popped open. A man of perhaps 30, wearing red spectacles hung from a red cord around his neck, came in. He was clearly furious. apparently not the winner of the argument then.
"Darks will stand," he snarled.
Kip shot to his feet. His chair skidded back, caught its legs, and went crashing to the floor. Kip flinched, smiled weakly an apology, and picked up the chair. The man continued staring at him, his mouth a tight white line. He had a large hooked nose and the deep olive skin of an Atashian, though he was beardless, but it was the eyes that captured Kip's attention. The brown eyes were interrupted by a hard circle of royal red in the middle of the iris. Scarlet streaks like sunbeams pierced the rest of the brown irises. Kip put the chair back as he'd found it, looked back to the man and got nothing, no hint of what he expected. Kip moved away from the chair. The man stared liquid hatred at him.
"Sorry," Kip mumbled, defensive. "Darks will not speak. Ignorant Tyrian trash."
"Oh, kiss my blubbery butt cheeks," Kip said. "Oops." He squeezed his eyes shut to curse himself so he didn't even see the blow coming. The fist cracked across his jaw, and the next thing he knew he was on the ground, drooling blood. Kip was slow to anger, usually, but he popped up to his feet almost as fast as he'd fallen, and the rage was there, everywhere. Everyone he knew was dead. Everything he cared about was gone. He didn't care if the drafter tore him apart. But as he bounced to his feet, he saw the light in the drafter's eyes. "Do it," the man's eyes said. "Give me the excuse. I will bounce you out of the Chromeria before you know what hit you." And like that, Kip's anger dropped into a more familiar channel, and he had control again. There was a footstep in the hall.
"Good," Kip said. "We've got something to build on there. A little clumsy for a kiss, but I understand your eagerness. I'm sure with that ugly face you don't get much practice." "But I said kiss my butt cheeks. Butt cheeks. Butt cheeks. Cheeks." He gestured. "They're different. Try again, this time with feeling."
The drafter's face went from incredulity to rage. He stepped forward and, just as the door opened, buried his fist in Kip's stomach. The drafter was distracted by the opening door and didn't put his full weight into the blow, but Kip doubled up as if it were the hardest blow he'd ever taken. He crumpled and coughed blood, retching.
"Magister Golden, what in Orholm's name is going on here?"
The drafter who'd hit Kip said,
He defied me!"
"So you struck him? Like the benighted do? Get out! Get out now! I'll deal with you later."
Magister Golden turned and stood over Kip.
"I'll remember this, and I'll find you some day when there's—"
"So help me, Orholm! If you threaten a student in my presence for your own malfeasance, Gents Golden, I will strip you of your colours and put you off Little Jasper this very hour. Test me! Please!"
Magister Golden looked absolutely stricken, like his life was falling apart without warning. That embarrassment and pain could be turned to rage, oh so easily. Sometimes Kip frightened himself. Magister Gents Golden was standing between him and the man who'd come in the door. Kip couldn't see the man, and that man couldn't see Kip. All he had to do was give Gents Golden a big, triumphant smile and leave his stomach open. The Magister would lose control. Kip knew all about losing control, and kick him. Kip would leave his stomach open, inviting it. Gents would kick him and lose everything. And for what, Kip? For having a temper and being an arsehole? Kip hesitated. The man had made him furious, but that was too much. But if Kip didn't smile, he'd have an enemy. An enemy he could destroy right now. Wherever that thought was going, he didn't get time to follow it. The moment passed. Gents Golden snarled and wheeled out of the room. Kip was left on the floor, the inside of his lips still lacerated, bleeding, and painful. He'd done what was right. Maybe he should have done what was smart. He picked himself up. The man who'd saved him was just poking his head out the door after Magister Golden. He said,
"Arion, I need you to conduct the testing."
A woman said,
"Lux, Lord, I'm not a tester.
"'And I don't want to wait while a new one is summoned,' he said sharply. "'I'm supposed to meet with the Prism in half an hour. "'We need to get started now.'
The Lux Lord came back into the room. He was a tall man wearing Elysian hose and doublet, though his skin was olive like Jens Golden's, rather than deep black. He was balding. His fringe of dark, wavy hair was streaked with white and brushed out long, halfway down his back. He was somewhere in his 50s, fit and wearing a heavy black woolen cloak embroidered with gold thread in intricate lattice. His fingers were burdened with wide gold rings and jewels of every colour of the spectrum, oddly worn between the knuckles in the middle of his fingers rather than closest to his hand. But Kip was learning to look at people's eyes, and the odd thing about the Lux Lord's eyes was perhaps that they were normal. They were green. There was no foreign colour shot through those eyes. The Lux Lord smiled.
"No," he said, "I'm not a drafter. The Black usually isn't. My name is Carver Black. Lux Lord Black, for most purposes."
The name didn't sound Atashian, so maybe he was Elysian. But Kip guessed the man could just as easily have grown up here or anywhere. Obviously, there was a lot of trade and movement among certain nations. Just not Tyria. Kip moved to speak, stopped, pointed to his lips.
"Yes," the Lux Lord said. "You can speak. We'll begin momentarily. As soon as Arion is ready."
Nice to meet you, Lux Lord Black. I'm Kip."
"And you, Magister?" Lux Lord Black asked. "Are you ready?"
"Yes, Lux Lord," she said.
She sat at the chair and the Black stood beside the table. Kip came to stand in front of the table himself. Magister Arion was short and skinny, nervous around the Black, but happy and cute. She looked up at Kip like she wanted him to succeed. He tried not to let her orange eyes disturb him.
"Supplicant," she said, "I'm going to lay out a series of coloured tiles from one tone to another. You will arrange the tiles in order."
She smiled suddenly.
"We'll start easy."
With that, she opened a bag in her lap, rummaged through the tiles for a bit, and extracted a black tile and a white tile. These she laid at the edges of the table. Then she laid a dozen tiles in various shades of grey in between. Kip quickly moved them into place from lightest to darkest. Arion said nothing, simply checked the backs of the tiles, made marks on a parchment, and swept the tiles off the table and back into the bag. Then she laid out brown tiles, from a tumbleweed to sepia. This was harder, but Kip swapped tiles quickly once more. The test was repeated with blues, greens, yellows, oranges, and reds. When Kip got the reds perfect, Arion pulled out a black bag, checked the backs of the tiles carefully, shielding them from Kip's eyes with a hand as she did so, and lined up another series of reds. Except this group had twice as many tiles, so the gradations of colour were much, much finer. Scarlets, vermilions, strawberry, raspberry, cerise. Kip lined them up and only had trouble with one. The colour at the edge of that tile was slightly darker than the colour on its face. Finally, he put it in its spot by the colour on its face. She flipped the tiles over, and Kip saw that he'd put tile 14 between tiles 9 and 10. Arion winked at him apologetically, as if he'd done better than she expected, despite failing.
"That's not right," Kip said.
"Silence," Lux Lord Black said. "I know you don't know our ways, supplicant, but you will not speak during the testing."
"But it's wrong," Kip said.
"I'm warning you."
Kip raised his hands in silent protest. Lux Lord Black sighed.
"Magister,"
he asked,
"usually protests have to be lodged after the test results are finalized, but apparently nothing is going to go according to custom today. A judgment, please."
Arion flipped the tiles back over, as Kip had had them lined up. She cleared her throat awkwardly.
"Lux Lord, I'm sorry. I'm not a super chromat. I tried to tell you. I can't tell the difference myself. The key says that
The key is being challenged,"
Lux Lord Black scratched an eye with one finger.
"Half of women super chromats, and I choose... Never you mind, go get a super chromat, Magister."
"Yes, Lux Lord," she said meekly.
She left,
and the Lux Lord turned his green eyes to Kip.
"Who are you, really? Why are you testing today? Why the special treatment? Where are you from?"
"I'm from Tyria, sir. King Haridul wiped out my..."
"King? What's this about?"
The door opened and Magister Arion came in, followed by a woman who looked like a scarecrow. She was almost as tall as Luxlord Black, lean as a rail, with faded brown skin, bones sticking out at sharp angles, wrinkled, her kinky hair white and short, with only a few wisps of something darker clinging to the tips. The natural mahogany of her eyes, eclipsed by orange and red in jagged starbursts through her irises, reaching almost to the outer edge.
"Mistress Kerawan Veridos, I'm sorry to disturb you,"
Luxlord Black said. He shot a look at Arion.
"She was just in the hall. She asked what I was doing,"
Arion said defensively.
"Nearly bowled me over. What's this challenge?"
the old woman asked. The tiles were lying face up the way Kip had left them.
"How did the supplicant order them?"
Silence. The mistress looked from Luxlord Black to Magister Arion.
"That is the way he ordered them," Arion said.
"So he's a freak to his gender. I'll be done."
"The key says it should be like this,"
Magister Arion said. She turned the tiles over and pointed to the numbers on the back.
"You come to me to differentiate the finest red chroma, and you think I can't read?"
Mistress Veridos asked sharply. Magister Arion looked horrified, her mouth opened and shut. The old scarecrow picked up tile 14 in her bony claws. She turned it and looked at the edges.
"Strip your tester of her position," she said. "This tile has been left in the sunlight. It's been bleached. It's the wrong colour. The boy's a super chromat."
She turned to Kip.
"Congratulations, freak."
"Freak?" Kip said.
"Simple, is he? Too bad."
"What?" Kip asked. He still hadn't figured out what everyone's titles meant, much less what he was supposed to do with all of this.
"Kip, you're forbidden to speak," Magister Arion said.
"That's an injunction against cheating," Luxlord Black said, "for when hundreds of supplicants are testing in the same room."
"He just came today,"
Magister Arion told Mistress Veridos.
"The Prism himself ordered that he be tested immediately. He doesn't know all the rules."
"Continue the testing," the mistress ordered.
Kip and Magister Arion glanced at Luxlord Black. Kip guessed that, technically, the Luxlord was the highest-ranking person in the room, but the man gave the tiniest shrug, as if it wasn't worth fighting over. "Go on," he waved. Mistress Arion sat once more, pulled out a set of tongs, and used them to lay out another dozen tiles. Except these were all the same deep red. Kip blinked. Magister Arion handed him the tongs. Thanks? Kip reached a hand out for a tile, and then he understood. He could feel the heat radiating off them. He was supposed to see the differences in heat. He stared, as if by sheer willpower he could tear the truth out of the tiles. Time crawled past. Kip started to daydream. He wondered if Liv Danavis was here. Oh, no, he'd have to tell her. "Hi, Liv, great to see you. Your father's dead." Fantastic. Kip thought about the flames roaring through his town, about that drafter and his apprentice throwing fireballs, jumping over the waterfall, running down the waterfall path in the utter darkness, relaxing his eyes so he could actually see better than focusing directly. "Oh, Orholam, I am simple."
"Okay, that's long enough,"
Luxlord Black said.
"No, wait, wait, I just...
Kip stared at the tiles again. "Relax, eyes. Come on." He let his focus go soft, and abruptly it was clear. Using the tongs, he shuffled each tile into its correct place in moments, from the hottest to the merely warm. This was what Master Danavis had been teaching him? The old dyer had never let on that what he was showing Kip wasn't normal. Unbelievable. The thought of the dyer left a hollow in Kip's stomach. Master Danavis had been good to him, inventing chores he probably could have done faster himself just to give Kip a little money. And like everyone in Recton, he'd been slaughtered. Kip hoped Master Danavis had taken some of the bastards with him.
"Are we almost done?"
he asked roughly. He wanted to be alone.
He was too tired, his emotions erratic, the reality of what had happened in Recton trying to rush in and overwhelm him now that he had a second where he wasn't running from soldiers or bandits or having magic thrown at him.
"No," the old scarecrow said. "Don't bother, girl," she told Arion, who'd only flipped over half of the tiles. "He got them all correct. Show him the superviolets."
Magister Arion put away the hot tiles with a glance at Lux Lord Black, who seemed unfazed. Then she pulled out the last tiles, which were all the same deep violet. "Relax my eyes to see one side of the spectrum, so..." Kip tightened his eyes as hard as he could, and the colours leapt apart. Someone had written a letter on each tile. It read, "Nicely done." Kip laughed. He slapped them into place. Magister Arion looked at Mistress Maridos.
"Why are you looking at me, you fool girl?" the old woman asked. "I can't see superviolets. I'm at the other end of the spectrum."
The younger woman blushed and flipped over the tiles. They were in the correct order.
"Congratulations, boy," Mistress Faridos said. "You can be some satrap's gardener."
"What?" Kip asked.
"It's one use for excellent colour matches, and a step up for you, Tyrion."
The door opened and Commander Ironfist stepped in.
"What's this?" he asked.
"We've just finished testing the supplicant," Magister Arion said. "He's a full-spectrum superchromat."
"You're wasting his time with tiles? I don't care what colours he can see. I want to know what he can draft. Where's that idiot tester I started with? I told him to put Kip through the thresher."
"You're putting a raw supplicant through the thresher?" Mistress Faridos asked.
"Wait, this wasn't the thresher?" Kip asked.
"Do you feel threshed?" Ironfist asked.
"You're putting a raw supplicant through the thresher?"
the mistress asked again.
"He's leaving in the morning. The Prism demands to know his capabilities before they go."
"This is highly irregular," the mistress said. "Who is this boy?"
"I'm right here," Kip said, irritated.
"Regular or irregular is irrelevant," Ironfist said. "Can you and this magister assist in the testing or not?"
"Me?" Magister Arion asked, alarmed. "I don't think I..."
"We can do it,"
the mistress began.
"Good then,"
Ironfist said.
"But I demand to know who he is first." "I'm right here," Kip said.
"Don't you raise your voice to me, boy,"
the mistress said, stabbing the air in front of his nose with one bony claw.
"Who are you, boy?"
Lux Lord Black asked quietly, even as the voices continued to rise.
"I think I'd really prefer not to help with the thresh," Arion was saying.
"You'll have no standing to make demands, mistress,"
Ironfist was saying to the old woman.
"I'm Kip Guile," Kip shouted. "I'm Gavin Guile's bastard, Kip."
Silence. Kip looked from one face to another. Lux Lord Black merely looked shocked. Magister Arion looked stunned to the point of tears. Commander Ironfist looked peeved. Mistress Varidos looked oddly satisfied.
"Ah," she said, "then we'll start the thresher immediately. Girl," she ordered Arion, "go get the room ready. Summon the testers."
She looked at Kip.
"So, maybe not a gardener after all."
"Go bend yourself over a fence," Kip said. But only to himself. Chapter 38 Liv Danavis climbed the last steps to the top of the Chromeria, glancing around nervously. She was at the head of the short line of her classmates, carrying her chair awkwardly high so she didn't catch it on the steep stairs. At first she thought the deck was empty. Then she saw him, her target, her last chance. The Prism was standing right at the edge of the building, leaning out, looking east, past the Red Tower, studying the ships in Sapphire Bay. Though Gavin Guile was literally twice Liv's 17 years, he cut a fine figure in the afternoon sun. A sharp V, from broad shoulders to narrow waist, arm thick with muscle where the wind was blowing one sleeve up. His copper-coloured hair streamed in the wind. He had that odd combination, uncommon even among the high houses of the Seven Satrapies, of red hair and, instead of the freckled skin that would mark him a blood forester, deeply tanned skin. Could it be true? Could this man be Kip's father?
Liv! Move!
Vina hissed. Liv started. She'd stopped right at the top of the steps, blocking the rest of the class. She hurried forward, blushing. She knew it was bad when oblivious Vina noticed something. Perfect. Liv was going to hear about this. If not from Magister Goldthorne, certainly from a few of the less friendly girls in the class. As the six girls took their places, there were no boys in the class, the prism saw them. He pulled himself away from the edge of the tower and walked to the head of the class. As when they sat in their normal class, though mercifully the days of solid book learning were mostly past, Liv took the second row. Her poor, joining her friend Vina's oblivious artist, and Arana's plain merchant's daughter. The girls who somehow embodied beautiful, rich, connected, noble, preening and gifted into only three bodies took the front row, as they always demanded. Magister Goldthorne, barely 3 years older than her disciples, did everything those girls wanted. Gavin Gall came to stand in front of the class. "Hail, disciples," he said. It was the traditional teacher's greeting. "Hail, Magister," they said in unison, answering without thinking about whether they actually should address him by some other title. He was the prism, after all. "Good," he said, giving a lopsided grin. Or Hollum, he was cute. "Today I am only a magister, and you are only glims."
"Gleams,"
Liv corrected, without thinking. She shrank into her chair as Magister Goldthorne hissed, and all the girls turned disbelieving stares at her, correcting the prism. He could say up was down and everyone should nod and smile. But he didn't look upset. He just stared at Liv for a long moment with those unsettling, prismatic eyes. "Ah, yes," he said. "Well, since you are advanced students, I suppose you have questions for me. What's your name?"
"Me?"
Liv asked. Of course he meant me. He's looking right at me.
Liv.
Liv? She blushed harder.
Oliviana.
Liv.
Liv Danavis.
Had she added that last part, hoping he would notice? Wouldn't she have just said Liv, otherwise? Was she trying to ingratiate herself, just as her Hrothgari masters wanted?
"Well done,"
Beautiful whispered from the front row. "Only took you 3 tries. Related to General Danavis?" Liv swallowed.
"Yes, sir. He's my father."
"Committed now. Well done, Liv." "He was a good man." He said it as if he genuinely respected the man who'd been responsible for so many of his own men's deaths.
"He was a rebel."
She couldn't keep the bitterness out of her voice. Bitterness that her father had lost everything in the war, including her mother. Bitterness that she was always going to be different. Bitterness that her father never spoke of the False Prisms War, never even tried to justify fighting for the wrong side. And not many of the rebels were good men, making your father even more remarkable. "Do you have a question, Oliviana?" All the students were supposed to have prepared questions. But beautiful, rich, and connected in the front row usually dominated any time the class had with important drafters, so Liv hadn't expected to get the chance to ask hers. She hesitated.
"I have a question,"
Beautiful said. Her real name was Anna, and she leaned forward eagerly, crossing her arms under her breasts. It was reasonably warm on top of the Chromaria, but Anna had to be cold, considering how little of her body that dress covered. The combination of Anna's frustratingly effortless natural beauty, short skirts and deep cleavage, was rarely lost on male magisters.
"Wait, I do have a question,"
Liv said. She'd already brought up that she was Corvin Danavis's daughter. The only way she could be more interesting to him, and make him suspect more that she was a spy, was by volunteering that she was from Recton and knew Kip. And the only way out was to go much, much further. "Dear Orholm, please—" "Yes, Liv," Gavin said. But he didn't look at her. Face expressionless, he was staring hard at Anna. He glanced down at her propped-up cleavage, then back to her eyes, and shook his head just a fraction. "Yes, I see. No, I'm not amused."
Anna blanched. Her eyes dropped. She sat up and shifted in her chair to pull her skirt down. Thank God Holm Liv was in the back row, because she couldn't suppress her grin despite everything. "Liv?" Gavin asked, turning those prismatic eyes on her. Entrancing. She cleared her throat.
"I was wondering if you could talk to us about uses of yellow superviolet bichromacy."
"Why?" Gavin asked. Liv froze. Her prayer was answered. A chance. Magister Goldthorn interjected.
"How about we talk about superviolet blue bichromacy instead? It's far more common. Three of my disciples are bichromes. Anna here is nearly a polychrome."
Gavin ignored her. Liv hadn't thought this moment would ever come. She'd been trapped so long in this class, with these girls. In one more year she'd be finished. In fact, she'd mastered enough drafting that she could take the final examination right now and pass easily. She hadn't, because there was nothing good waiting for her when she finished. A terrible position, decoding official, non-secret communications for the Hrothgari noble who held her contract. She wouldn't even be trusted with secret communications. No matter that she'd been a babe in arms during the war and felt no loyalty to the rebels, she was Tyrian. It was enough to curse her, in the Chromeria's eyes. Each of the seven satrapies was responsible for the tuition of its own students. It was an investment every satrapy gladly made, because drafters were so vital to every part of their economies, their armies, their construction, their communications, their agriculture. But Tyria had nothing. The corrupt foreign governors of Garriston sent a pittance every year. Those students who came from Tyria mostly had to pay their own way. The Danavis's wealth had been stolen during the war, so Liv had needed to pledge her services to a Hrothgari patron just to stay at the Chromeria. If Liv were from any other satrapy, her ambassador would have forced her patron to pay for bichrome training for her or surrender her contract. But there was no Tyrian ambassador anymore. There was an official bursar's purse for hardship cases, like hers, but it had long ago become a slush fund for bureaucrats to reward their favourites. Tyria had no voice, no place.
"Liv asked because she's a yellow superviolet bichrome," Vina said.
Gavin turned and looked at her. Vina was an artist and dressed like one. Boyishly short hair, artfully dishevelled, lots of jewellery and clothing she'd tailored for herself. Half the time you couldn't even tell what country's style she was borrowing from, if any. But despite not being pretty, she was always striking and, in Liv's opinion anyway, looked great. Today Vina wore a flowing dress of her own invention, with silver embroidery at the hem reminiscent of the tree people's zoomorphic designs. The designs in the visible spectrum were echoed cleverly in the superviolet. "What a marvellous young woman you are," Gavin said to Vina, "and a good friend. I love your dress." As Vina blushed crimson, Gavin turned to Liv. "Is this true?"
"No, it's not," Magister Goldthorn said. "Liv's threshing was inconclusive, and since then she's shown no further abilities."
Liv pulled out the broken yellow spectacles, really only a monocle, that she'd bought secretly 2 years before. She held it up, squinted through one eye, and stared at the white stone of the prism's tower. In a moment, yellow luxin filled her cupped hands. It sloshed like water. Yellow luxin's natural state was liquid. It was the most unstable of any luxin, not just sensitive to light, but also to motion. At its best, it could be used mainly for two things. If held with will in liquid form, it made great torches. Or in a thin, sealed sheet, it would slowly feed light to other luxins, keeping them fresh, the same way that lanolin and beeswax rejuvenated leather. Liv threw the cut liquid aside. It didn't even make it to the ground. Instead, flash boiling in midair into pure yellow light. Magister Goldthorn spluttered.
"This is outrageous! You are forbidden to draft!"
"You are forbidden," Gavin interrupted her, "to squander the gifts Orholm has given you. You're Tyrian, Eliviana?" Magister Goldthorn stopped cold. One did not interrupt the prism himself, not twice.
"Yes," Liv said. "Little town not far from Sundered Rock, actually. Recton."
His eyes seemed to flash for a second, but it might have been Liv's imagination, because he said, "How long before you pulled the threshing rope?"
2 minutes 5 seconds, she said. It was considered a very long time. He looked hard at her. Then his expression softened. As stubborn as your father, I see. I barely made it past 1. Well done. So, super violet and yellow. Watch this. He held out both of his hands. Every girl's pupils tightened to tiny apertures. Superviolet Luxon was invisible to normal sight. Even a woman who could draft superviolet wouldn't see it unless she was looking for it. Your normal lessons have covered, doubtless to the point of your nausea, crafting missives with superviolet Luxon. Had they ever. Its invisibility was why superviolet drafters were used for communications. But on top of that, every satrapy was also looking into ciphers and methods of stacking, twisting, and obfuscating the superviolet written messages, locking the messages into fragile loops that would be broken by any but someone who knew the exact method to open and read them. Fun, for a while, but they'd passed the fun place a long, long time ago. "You know what superviolet is great for?" Gavin asked. "Tripping people." Every girl in the class grinned guiltily. All had done that at one time or another. "No, seriously, the pranks are where you learn to apply your colour in ways no one else has thought of. You have to be a little bad to make history. Sealed superviolet isn't as strong as blue or green, but it weighs almost..."